Was reading my pocket constitution earlier today, and there were some things that I guess I could use your insight on. So perhaps it would be best if we went through the entire document. So the preamble says, "We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America."
Okay, so we'll break down the preamble. And we discussed before that we the people were the source of the authority granted via the conventions, via the states, and then the nine states ratified the Constitution, which includes the preamble. A preamble is a description of the document. It's nothing more than that. It's not law in itself. Otherwise, it would be written differently. So, but in order to form a more perfect union, the Articles of Confederation had failed. And so what they wanted to do is create a more perfect union, one that was more viable, more functional than the unanimous requirements of the other one. Establish justice. Now there's an interesting one. It doesn't say establish laws, it says establish justice. And there will be much more that addresses this as we go on. Ensure domestic tranquility. Primarily to avoid disputes between states or resolve disputes. They wanted a peaceful society, and it was very, very much peaceful for, the first half century after the Constitution. Provide for the common defense. Now, this is a major element because the states could put down insurrection or repel invasion, which we'll get into later. But the defense of the whole, the same reason the Articles of Confederation were adopted, was the defense of the whole. And so this allows the federal government to provide for the defense of the whole based on sufficient numbers saying that we need to be defended. Promote the general welfare. This one, general welfare, I think we'll need to get a link to my article on general welfare in here. For some reason, Congress has changed that to provide the welfare instead of promote the general welfare. Welfare is the comfortable well-being. It's kind of like tranquility, but it was to, if there are serious problems within the country, to try and smooth those problems out so that people can just go on with life and live their life. The idea is for the government is created so that we can sit back and enjoy life, do our work, enjoy our family, enjoy our home, enjoy our property, life, liberty, property. And then to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Now, liberty, quick definition, your fist stops at my nose, that we have the freedom to do what we will as long as it doesn't have a detrimental effect on others. There are numerous kinds of liberty, but fundamentally, it's the right to live our lives. And to our posterity, now they wanted this. The Articles of Confederation was considered, it was a perpetual union. We don't see perpetual union in here, but we do pass it down to our posterity. So the removal of perpetual union kind of runs at odds with the secession during the Civil War and the secession from the Hartford Convention even earlier. But to our posterity, that they intended this to be in itself able to sustain to our posterity the benefits of the government document being created. Now, here's the purpose: do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Do ordain, bless, and establish, create this Constitution for the United States of America. One thing that's rather confusing to some people, it was to me for a while, it says Constitution for the United States of America. Yes, because the United States of America in this context did not exist, so it's a Constitution for the United States of America. When ratified, it brings it into the existence. Is commonly referred to as the Constitution of the United States of America, and after the fact, that title, which is not law, is appropriate. And that's the Constitution, the purpose of this document.
Let's look at Article 1. Article 1, Section 1. All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and House of Representatives.
So they created a bicameral Congress, in some respects similar to what the British had, where they had the House of Lords and the House of Commons. The Commons, the equivalent of the representatives, being not at that time, but subsequently, they followed our lead and redistributed the assignment of representatives in the House of Commons. But the Senate was supposed to be the wiser people, and so their term will get into 6 years. And the House of Representatives is a rolling ball. But all legislative power, that means the judicial branch of government can't legislate. The executive branch of government cannot legislate. All legislative powers herein granted by this Constitution shall be vested in a Congress. Okay.
Section 2. The House of Representatives shall be composed of members chosen every second year by the people of the several states, and the electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature.
Okay, now we'll get into the Electoral College later, but the House of Representatives will be composed of members chosen every second year, so it's a two-year term. This is the rolling one. It's you're in 2 years, you're out, or you get voted back in. So this is just setting the size. Not setting the size yet, but this is establishing the structure, basic structure of the House of Representatives. But it says the and the electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for the electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature. So the qualifications for electors at this point is based upon each state and what they do with their legislature. If you're qualified to serve on the state legislature, the numerous branch, which is the representative branch in the state legislature, then you're qualified to be an elector, which is one of those that chooses the president. Okay?
No person shall be a representative who shall not have attained to the age of 25 years and been 7 years a citizen of the United States, and who shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of that state in which he shall be chosen.
Okay, this one has created confusion over the years because of the last phrase, who shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of the state in which he shall be chosen. It sounds like he can't be an inhabitant of the state, and this led to discussions of residence, domicile, and things like that. But let's look at it. No person shall be a representative who shall not have attained the age of 25 years and been 7 years a citizen of the United States. Now, at that time, really, nobody was a citizen of the United States, but they had to have been in the United States. I guess they considered the United States to be under the Articles of Confederation because it was styled as that. But this confusing one, no person shall be a representative and who shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of the state in which he is chosen. So it's saying that if he's not an inhabitant of the state, he shall not be a representative. That bottom part can be confusing, but you have to look at the double negative aspect of it. Okay?
Representatives in direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union according to their respective numbers, which shall be determined by adding to the whole number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years, and excluding Indians not taxed, 3/5 of all other persons. The actual enumeration shall be made within 3 years after the first meeting of the Congress of the United States, and within every subsequent term of 10 years, in such manner as they shall by law direct. The number of representatives shall not exceed 1 for every 30,000, but each state shall have at least one representative, and until such enumeration shall be made, the state of New Hampshire shall be entitled to choose 3, Massachusetts 8, Rhode Island and Providence plantations 1, Connecticut 5, New York 6, New Jersey 4, Pennsylvania 8, Delaware 1, Maryland 6, Virginia 10, North Carolina 5, South Carolina 5, and Georgia 3.
So some of the states had performed censuses. Some had estimated their populations. So the enumeration at the bottom was the get-go representation in the House of Representatives. The census is dictated by the Constitution every 10 years, and at that point, then the numbers will be based upon the accurate census of those states. But representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states. Now, that's kind of interesting. So if one state has 40 representatives and one has 20 representatives, the taxes would be twice as high where there's 40 representatives than they were where there were 20 representatives. Now, that kind of makes sense because that puts the same amount on each head within the census. But we've gotten away from that. That's the apportionment provision, and the government's managed to get out of that without really saying that they're getting out of it. And that would expand to all the states which may be included within the union according to their respective numbers, which shall be determined by adding to the whole number of free persons. Now, including those bound by service for a term of years, which is indentured servants, and excluding, it would include them, excluding Indians not taxed, 3/5 of all persons, and 3/5 of all persons, indentured servitude was still in practice at the time, but that's basically been superseded by subsequent changes in the Constitution. The actual enumeration shall be made within 3 years after Congress. That's obsolete now because we're past that three-year period. But then every 10 years, so there's the census, the enumeration or the census being made, where adjustments every 10 years in the distribution in the House of Representatives shall occur. It said the number of representatives shall not exceed 1 for every 30,000. Now, that was replaced when the cap was set at 435 representatives. And right now, we're, I think, approaching 500,000 are represented by one representative now. So the influence that the voters had upon the representatives had been watered down to almost insignificant. I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but that every 30,000 was gone over in the debates on the Constitution, and it was as high as 40,000, but then it was brought back down to 30. But like I say, we're over 400,000 now. But each state shall have at least one representative. That's correct. And so then all the counting, the initial assignments again become moot at this point. Okay.
When vacancies happen in the representation from any state, the executive authority thereof shall issue writs of election to fill such vacancies.
Okay, now many states have, as I understand it, actually appoint somebody to replace, but this says that they should issue a writ of election. So I think there's been deviation from that, but the idea here is they want to keep the House of Representatives fully populated, so if somebody dies or anything, then the writs of election to fill the vacancies.
The House of Representatives shall choose their speaker and other officers, and shall have the sole power of impeachment.
Okay, that quite simply, the Speaker of the House and any other officers would be chosen by the House of Representatives, and they have the sole power of impeachment. Just understand, impeachment's two processes. The first one is bringing charges. It's kind of a grand jury indictment, so to speak. And then the trial for impeachment will be assigned to the Senate. Okay?
Section 3. the Senate of the United States shall be composed of 2 senators from each state, chosen by the legislature thereof for 6 years, and each senator shall have 1 vote.
Okay, now here's the 6-year term, and they'll be broken into 3 classes, which will be pointed out next, but each senator shall have 1 vote. Now, interestingly, in one of the Federalist Papers, Hamilton, I think it was 14, Hamilton was talking about where a republic and a democracy, the republic being the House of Representatives and the democracy being the Senate. Now, think about this. Each senator will have 1 vote, 2 senators per state. So every state has 2 votes. Now, that's a democracy where each state, member of the Senate, has equal votes with every other state, as opposed to the representatives, which is based on population rather than the unit state. Okay.
Immediately after they shall be assembled in consequence of the first election, they shall be divided as equally as may be into 3 classes. The seats of the senators of the first class shall be vacated at the expiration of the 2nd year, of the 2nd class at the expiration of the 4th year, and of the 3rd class at the expiration of the 6th year, so that 1/3 may be chosen every 2nd year. And if vacancies happen by resignation or otherwise, during the recess of the legislature of any state, the executive thereof may make temporary appointments until the next meeting of the legislature. We shall then fill such vacancies.
Okay, here they're creating classes. They don't enumerate the structure of the class, which ones will be which, and I'm not sure how that was decided. But at the time, the senators were selected by the state legislature, and that's changed since then. Now they're elected just like the representatives, and they become insignificant with regard to really supporting the interests of the states. But the executive could make a temporary appointment if the legislator was out, but otherwise it would be selected by the legislature of the state. So the government had an interim temporary authority to assign a replacement until the full senator could be returned.
No person shall be a senator who shall not have attained to the age of 30 years and been 9 years a citizen of the United States, and who shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of that state for which he shall be chosen.
Okay, now we've gone to 30 years and 9 years a citizen instead of 25 years and 7, and we've also got the double negative about being an inhabitant of the state. Okay.
The Vice President of the United States shall be President of the Senate, but shall have no vote unless they be equally divided.
Okay, the vice president had, and they realized this in the discussions, unless the president died or was otherwise unable to perform his duties, the vice president had nothing to do, so they decided to make him the president of the Senate. And he fills that. The vice president shall be president of the Senate. The vice president really has no real duties in the Constitution except to replace the president. Or he can stand in for him through disability. So they had to give him a job, and it was discussed in the debates. But he has no vote except to break a tie. Okay.
The Senate shall choose their other officers, and also a president pro tem, in the absence of the vice president, or when he shall exercise the office of president of the United States. The Senate shall have the sole power to try all impeachments. When sitting for that purpose, they shall be on oath or affirmation. When the President of the United States is tried, the Chief Justice shall preside, and no person shall be convicted without the concurrence of 2/3 of the members present.
Okay, the Senate chooses their officers as they did in the House. The President pro tem, who becomes the President of the Senate when the Vice President is absent. Now the Senate shall have the sole power of impeachment. This is the jury trial. The Chief Justice of the United States shall preside if the president is being impeached. Now impeachment can apply to Anybody in office in the United States, some of the senior officers, not the clerks and things. So if the impeachment is for, and there have been quite a few over the years, but if the impeachment is anybody other than the vice or the president, then the vice president or the president pro tem of the Senate would preside over it. And it requires a two-thirds majority to convict.
Judgment in cases of impeachment shall not extend further than to removal from office, and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States. But the party convicted shall nevertheless be liable and subject to indictment, trial, judgment, and punishment according to law.
Okay, so what this basically says is the only thing that the impeachment will do if he's convicted is removal from office and disqualification from holding future offices within the United States. It doesn't mean, however, that he can't be tried, indicted and tried outside once he's impeached, but he's protected, well, with the government, but if impeached, then he becomes subject to indictment, trial, and judgment of punishment according to the law. And that could be federal or state law. Okay.
Section 4. The times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. But the Congress may at any time by law make or alter such regulations, except as to the places of choosing senators.
Now, this is kind of confusing, and why they would do it is beyond me, and I can't find an answer in my research of why they did it. But the times and places are for holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. But Congress can say, screw you, we want to do it our way, and the only thing they can't do is change the places of choosing senators, which at that time was in the state legislature. Now it's not anymore. So basically they said, here's how we're going to do it, but if we change our mind, we can dictate how it will be done, which I don't know what kind of compromise, and I cannot find what kind of compromise was considered for making that rather hypocritical presentation of authorities.
The Congress shall assemble at least once in every year, and such meeting shall be on the first Monday in December, unless they shall by law appoint a different day.
Okay, well, they meet once a year, and they've changed the day, I think, now until January. But that's just setting that they will meet once a year. Now they can be called into special session, which will be addressed later. But they've changed the day by law. Okay.
Section 5. Each house shall be the judge of the elections, returns and qualifications of its own members, and a majority of each shall constitute a quorum to do business. But a smaller number may adjourn from day to day and may be authorized to compel the attendance of absent members in such manner and under such penalties as each house may provide.
They've adjusted the rules, but in the past there were a number of times when a party would refuse to come in and create the quorum. And in some cases they were, I'm going to say, arrested and brought back to the chambers and put in. It's happened a few times in our history. It created a bit of a problem, too, to have a quorum during the Civil War when 10 states seceded, which has to do with the rapid recognition of West Virginia in violation of the Constitution becoming a state so that they could have a quorum to proceed with business in the House of, well, actually to give them the two-thirds when required. They had to get West Virginia in to get enough people to get the two-thirds required in many cases.
Each house may determine the rules of its proceedings, punish its members for disorderly behavior, and, with the concurrence of two-thirds, expel a member.
Now, this one, there was a senator named Thomas Benton back in the early 1800s in reading his works. This was a concern even back then because the House punishes the House, the Senate punishes the Senate, and expulsion requires two-thirds to get somebody out. Now, if you're all in the same club and you're all breaking the same rules or doing something contrary to good government practices, to be polite about it, if they're all doing it, they're not going to punish anybody for being disorderly or expel anybody. The only time they expel somebody is when that person, hey, he might be doing things right or calling them on it, and so they just gang up on him. There's a perfect rule for bullying in that clause of the Constitution, okay?
Each house shall keep a journal of its proceedings and from time to time publish the same, excepting such parts as may in their judgment require secrecy. And the yeas and nays of the members of either house on any question shall, at the desire of one-fifth of those present, be entered on the journal.
Okay, now this is currently called the Congressional Record. In the past, it was called the Congressional Gazette. But there is available online, all the way back to the Continental Congress, a record of the proceedings, and they're verbatim for the most part. So this record keeping was necessary. Now, the issue of vote count, the only time they're recorded is when it's required. I think they've made some rules for certain votes to be required anyway. They've established rules, but sometimes it's just, you know, viva voice, whichever side is the loudest wins. Okay.
Neither house during the session of Congress shall, without the consent of the other, adjourn for more than 3 days, nor to any other place than that in which the two houses shall be sitting.
Okay, this is, since they have to concur on any, almost everything they do. Impeachment is strictly with the House. Treaty ratification and certain selections for officers is strictly on the Senate. But the idea is you can't have one body sitting doing their business and the other one can't be there to concur so that it could go to the president for signing or something like that. Makes sense. Okay.
Section 6. The senators and representatives shall receive a compensation for their services, to be ascertained by law, and paid out of the Treasury of the United States. They shall in all cases, except treason, felony, and breach of the peace, be privileged from arrest during their attendance at the session of their respective houses, and in going to and returning from the same. And for any speech or debate in either house, they shall not be questioned in any other place.
Okay, this one, the senators and representatives shall receive a compensation for their services. That's like a salary, it would seem to me, by the specific wording. And it used to be that way. They got X dollars for the their services. But over the years, they've managed to extend it to haircuts. Well, the franking privilege by the post office is one that's always been there. But haircuts, gymnastics, flights around the world, phenomenal sums for their staff. That the budgets, the allowances these people have, which are not part of that compensation for their services, and especially their pensions, are unbelievable. And the Constitution only authorizes compensation for their services. You can't compensate somebody for non-services after they left office, but they have enacted laws that give them very substantial allowances and pensions. after they get out, and we're stuck with Social Security or 501, 401k programs. They, in all cases except treason, felony, and breach of the peace, be privileged from arrest during their attendance. And now there have been some battles on the floor of the Senate, hitting with canes and umbrellas, that were not punished. But felony and treason are I don't know if any have ever been successfully pursued. But they're protected, they're immune. If it happens in the chambers, the idea quite simply is it happens in chambers, there is no legal recourse except by the House or the Senate, the respective House, for anything that's discussed within those walls. In the 1820s, there was a duel between Henry Clay and James Randolph. And the challenge by Clay was something that Randolph said in session. Randolph, being an honorable Virginia gentleman, refused to demand the exception because of this provision, and so they went and had the duel. Well, both people missed, and they satisfied the honor aspect of it, but it's very rigid. If you say it in there, and it makes sense that they can say anything they want in trying to get something passed. They can lie, cheat, and steal. But if they're trying to get a point across, they have to be able to not feel that they'll be punished for what they say.
No senator or representative shall, during the time for which he was elected, be appointed to any civil office under the authority of the United States, which shall have been created, or the emoluments whereof shall have been increased during such time. And no person holding any office under the United States shall be a member of either house during his continuance in office.
Okay, now this sets the distinction between the legislatures and any other aspect of government, that you can't hold two offices, especially if you created the office or created the office. There was a proposed amendment at one time that was not supported by enough of the Congress to be submitted to the states. They would have required the same provisions and at least 1 year out of an elected position before you could take any other position. Patronage was and continues to be a serious problem in government, and this was recognized back in the early 1800s as well, because if the president gives appointments to people, if he were a congressman, he could make him the postmaster too, so the guy would be double-dipping, and he would have an allegiance to the president, but he would supposed to be independent because he was in the legislature. And so patronage is still a problem today. Hillary Clinton became Secretary of State, and she wasn't elected. There was somebody else that John Kerry, yeah. John Kerry went to Secretary of State from being a senator, and had that other provision been there, you got to wonder what votes he might have cast for the promise that he would become Secretary of State. One year distinction, or another proposal at one time that didn't go through, was under the term of the president, so that a president could not offer patronage and then assign somebody that wasn't in one of these elected positions into a higher position after he got voted out or resigned. So the next president then would be the only one that could appoint him, which would have taken away patronage. But Congress doesn't want to take away their bread and butter, so they have never allowed those two alternatives to the separation to be sent to the people for their concurrence.
Section 7. All bills for raising revenue shall originate in the House of Representatives, but the Senate may propose or concur with amendments as on other bills.
Now, this is kind of interesting, because if we look at the original method of selection of senators being by the states, And if we look at the apportionment aspect of it, where the apportionment of any taxes would be based on the number of representatives, first, the people's representatives would say, we need money, and they would submit the bill out of the House of Representatives. However, the senators, if the state legislator said, look, our people are being taxed to death, senators, we don't want you to approve that bill, the state would be a bit of a buffer, at least in states where there wasn't a healthy economy, for example, and they didn't want to see taxes go up. But by changing, with the 17th Amendment, changing the selection of the senators, that logical influence of the Senate representing the state disappeared, and now we have just elected people saying, we want more money, we want more money, we want more money, and now it's obscene.
Every bill which shall have passed the House of Representatives and the Senate shall, before it become a law, be presented to the President of the United States. If he approves, he shall sign it, but if not, he shall return it, with his objections to that House in which it shall have originated, who shall enter the objections at large on their journal and proceed to reconsider it. If after such reconsideration 2/3 of that House shall agree to pass the bill, it shall be sent, together with the objections, to the other House, by which it shall likewise be reconsidered, and if approved by 2/3 of that House, it shall become a law. But in all cases the votes of both Houses shall be determined by yeas and nays, and the names of the persons voting for and against the bill shall be entered on the journal of each House respectively. If any bill shall not be returned by the President within 10 days, Sundays excepted, after it shall have been presented to him, the same shall be a law, in like manner as if he had signed it, unless the Congress by their adjournment prevent its return, in which case it shall not be a law.
So there are three ways of a bill becoming a law with regard to the executive approval or absence of approval. If the president signs it, it becomes a law. If the president doesn't sign it, but it sits for 10 days, it becomes a law unless it was at the end of the legislative session. It does not become a law. And then the veto power of the president can be overridden by a 3/4 vote of the House and Senate. And interestingly, at the end of the Civil War, Lincoln was assassinated, Andrew Johnson became president. The Thaddeus Stevens was the guy that was really the head of Reconstruction. A number of bills were submitted to Johnson, and he wrote very lengthy and well-articulated arguments against the constitutionality of the actions before included within the bill. They were logical constitutional arguments, but they could get the three-quarters majority in both houses to override the veto without justifying trying to justify the constitutionality. And one of the more interesting was is Lincoln had basically granted amnesty to everybody that fought for the South. Reconstruction then wanted to punish these people, and it made them, until they took the oath and did certain steps and were accepted by the House and the Senate back into, they lost those rights that Lincoln gave back to them, and that was one of the bills that Jackson vetoed, and they overrode it with no constitutional justification and in defiance of what Lincoln had done when he was president. So it's a bad system because it doesn't require constitutional justification to override a veto if the president feels it's unconstitutional. Okay?
Every order, resolution, or vote to which the concurrence of the Senate and House of Representatives may be necessary, except on a question of adjournment, shall be presented to the President of the United States, and before the same shall take effect, shall be approved by him, or being disapproved by him shall be repassed by two-thirds of the Senate and House of Representatives, according to the rules and limitations prescribed in the case of a bill.
Okay, here basically the same thing, veto, but we're talking about every order, resolution, or vote which the concurrence of the Senate and House of Representatives may be necessary. So anytime anything goes to both houses, so that's not the rules for the House nor the rules for the Senate, but a resolution making George Washington's birthday or something like that would also require presidential approval. If it goes to both houses, it's treated just like a bill. And so they're as prescribed in the case of a bill. So anything that comes out of both houses has to be addressed in the same way to have any official sanction of the government. But the veto override is still there.
Section 8. The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States.
Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises. Excise tax is a use tax. You know, go back in history and the tax on making alcohol, for example, in western Pennsylvania. Imposts and duties, I get confused over these two, but basically they're on commerce. Import duties and things like that. Now, taxes is rather ambiguous here, but we'll address that later. And the purpose to pay the debts of the United States and to provide for the common defense and general welfare. General welfare, not provide welfare, but to provide for the general welfare, which is the well-being of the country. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. Now, they have to be uniform. You can't charge more for one state and one less in another state. But if all the tires are made in one place, then or in, say, two states, they would have to be the same in both states, but they wouldn't obviously apply in the other states that don't make tires. Okay?
To borrow money on the credit of the United States.
Now, this is interesting because Jefferson got into a very extensive analysis of debt and longevity, and I think it was he felt the debt should not go beyond 18 years because that was really the average cycle of a generation. So a generation could only impose a tax upon itself, so to speak. But what we have now is because the debt is so great that we're making interest-only payments on it for the most part, and so it's perpetual. It's 10 generations, 20, 50, 100 generations from now, we'll still be paying the debt that we have today unless something's done. So now remember, they had a clean sheet of paper, and they were honorable men. And they didn't borrow to this extent. They didn't borrow to start wars. They didn't borrow to feed people that weren't willing to work for a living. None of that stuff occurred back then. But now the government has become a philanthropical organization and gives money to other nations. Millions for defense, but not 1 cent for tribute. But we give tribute to countries all around the world. We buy favors all around the world, and it's just gone overboard. You know, there should have been more specificity to that, but it was a clean sheet, and they didn't know what problems were going to arise as a consequence of this.
To regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes.
Okay, now if the states were to regulate commerce with foreign nations, one might charge a higher tariff, the other one might charge a lesser tariff, and it would give favor to the state that was, it would become a, you know, a bidding competition to see who could get do the most favor for foreign nations. And for the general welfare, it was necessary for that to be established in uniform. Same thing among the states, and this, especially any state like Well, Kentucky wasn't a state then, but they knew states, there would be inland states. Pennsylvania did have a port, and the rivers were used more extensively than they are now with shipping. But an inland state, if the seaboard state that was the nearest port could charge whatever they wanted, it would make something from those inland states without the seaboard and without the ports. Have to pay a premium to ship their goods to a foreign country. And with the Indian tribes, now we'll recognize Indians later on, but the government wanted uniformity with trade with the Indian tribes as well. And it made sense that even though the states were autonomous to a large degree, for stability and non-competition among the states, that these authorities be granted. Let me back up just a minute. Earlier, we had talked about the powers and authorities granted to Congress, and these are the powers. This is Article 1, Section 8, is the powers granted. All of these are powers granted to. And when we read each of these, we said to borrow money in the credit of the United States. The way it reads is the Congress shall have the power to borrow money on the credit of the United States, to regulate the power to regulate commerce. So these are all powers granted to the government.
To establish a uniform rule of naturalization and uniform laws on the subject of bankruptcies throughout the United States.
Okay, the rule on naturalization wasn't really applied for a long time. They didn't apply one because there's reference all the way into the mid-1800s that recognized that states granted citizenship, and the federal government really didn't get involved. Even though they had the power, they did not apply that power until after the Civil War. And then it's gone through various conditions. They used to be fairly rigid. They involved quotas from different countries, degrees of education, or abilities, work abilities, through most of our history after the Civil War. But now they've become so lax, and even though the laws are there, the rules are there, they're ignored completely. And uniform laws on the subject of bankruptcies throughout the United States. Yes, you cannot file bankruptcy because there's intercourse between the two states. It wouldn't be right for, say, Florida and Georgia, Florida to allow a guy to declare bankruptcy when he owed a lot of money in Georgia. So because of that commerce between states, the only thing that made sense was that the federal government handled bankruptcies, not the state governments. Okay?
To coin money, regulate the value thereof, and a foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measures.
Okay, to coin money. Now that means to coin money, to make coins out of gold and silver. And gold and silver will be addressed later. And it went for a long time like this, that money was coined. They did issue bills of credit called silver certificates or gold certificates, but each of them was backed by the Treasury, not the Federal Reserve, but the Treasury notes were backed by gold or silver in the depositories. What's the exchange value of the English pound? Again, that had to be established by the federal government because it couldn't be dealt with differently by each state. Otherwise, the state that gave more dollars per pound would get more trade with the foreign country. So that is a balancing of trade. And then the standards of weights and measures. How much is a pound? What is a dozen? Any of these measurements, what is a gallon, had to be standard throughout the country. You couldn't have each state decide what it wanted to do within itself because it would be confusing to everybody, and it would be difficult from the point of taxation if taxation were approved for a commodity.
To provide for the punishment of counterfeiting the securities and current coin of the United States.
Oh, now here's a crime. To provide for punishment of counterfeiting the securities and current coin of the United States. The securities would be bills of credit. Well, a bank, let me say notes, United States notes. I said it wrong in the previous one. But to counterfeit a gold certificate or a silver certificate, or to make lead coins and then gold plate them. This is a crime against the whole structure and consolidation of the money system within the country.
To establish post offices and post roads.
Well, Ben Franklin started the post offices in this country, and the post roads were the network by which post offices would be accessed. You know, there had to be a way to get from here to there, and there had to be a way to deliver the mail. So this gave Congress, the federal government, the authority internally within the states to assure that there were means of transporting the mail from post office to post office.
To promote the progress of science and useful arts, by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries.
Now, this is kind of interesting, because if we look at subsequent legislation and what it's done, that there's reason to believe that there are carburetors that have been invented and, say, bought by Standard Oil, and then they park it in their safe and they own the patent on it, so nobody can make it without their consent. Now, it used to be license fees, but now it's consent, or maybe it's still license fees, but they'd have to pay phenomenal prices. But it says to promote the progress of science and useful arts. So if we're promoting something, we can't use this law to hide things. But Congress has enacted laws that allow people to buy a patent and park it and deny it for 26 years twice, I think, is or 28 years twice, or is that copyright? But at any rate, they've allowed the private use of this to deny the promotion of progress in science. And that probably has a lot to do with the money they receive for being able to cover these things up. But it made sense throughout the states that if I wrote a book in Florida, that you couldn't copy that book, plagiarize it, and sell it in Georgia. This had to be national. But I think it's been abused, because there are many instances of a presumption of ownership and the ability to deny the promotion of progress in science by hiding it.
To constitute tribunals inferior to the Supreme Court.
What these are commonly referred to as the Article 3 courts, Article 3, these are actually Article 1 courts. They're created by the Congress. The only one created by Article 3 is the Supreme Court, and we'll get there later. So the inferior courts were all established by the legislature, so the Article 3, the Supreme Court, the judicial branch, could not go create their own courts.
To define and punish piracies and felonies committed on the high seas, and offenses against the law of nations.
Oh, there's another crime. They get to define and punish piracy and felonies committed on the high seas. Piracy and felonies committed on the high seas, not felonies committed in Texas. And offenses against the laws of nations. Now, these are all international in nature. And, you know, every country has, every civilized country has laws on piracy, felonies committed on the high seas, and offenses against the laws of nations, because if there's piracy, what's the jurisdiction? Well, whoever captures them really assumes jurisdiction. And so this made sense. But it is the second crime, counterfeiting and piracy and felonies committed on the high seas and offenses against the laws of nations. Okay.
To declare war, grant letters of marque and reprisal, and make rules concerning captures on land and water.
Okay. Congress shall have the power to declare war. It's granted nowhere else. There was a notable exception during the time of Jefferson's presidency with the Barbary Coast, Barbary pirates, where he could not go to Congress and declare war, give up his hand. But what he did is he sent the Marines and the Navy over there The Marines kind of came in behind the Tripoli and took over, killed a bunch of people, freed as many of the captured sailors. Now, what this came over is American ships were being captured by the Barbary pirates. The ships sold, the goods sold, and the people that were taken were sold into slavery. To stop this, Jefferson secretly sent Marines and Navy over there to release the prisoners, get whatever cargoes and ships could be returned, and return them to the United States. That's not a war. It's an immediate action. But unfortunately, that's evolved to we've got the longest war in our history that was never declared by Congress now, and that's Afghanistan. And Iraq is just a few months behind it. Grant letters of marque and reprisal. Letters of marque were the privateers. And there were a lot of them during the Revolutionary War. They were granted letters of marque. They could go out and capture British ships, take the goods, take the ship, sell them. The letters of marque might require that a certain amount of it go to the government and then make rules concerning captures on land and water. And this evolved from the Revolutionary War, and captures on land and water. For example, Tory homes were kind of included in captures on land. They were seized by the colonies, and the Treaty of 1783 required that land still belong to the Tories. So, but these this is the war clause. Only Congress has the power to declare war.
To raise and support armies, but no appropriation of money to that use shall be for a longer term than 2 years.
Well, they just roll the budget now. The intention here was each seating of the House of Representatives would grant 2 years, and the next House of Representatives would determine the necessity. Raise and support armies. Was there a necessity? We've never been without an army since the Revolutionary War. Opening up the Western frontiers required the army and the cavalry out west, and you know, we watched too much television. There were a lot of just infantry out there. They marched days, weeks, months. They walked more in a month than you probably do most of us would do in 5 or 10 years. But they were necessary, so we never went without having an army in place for protection of certain areas of the country. But now we've got armies in many, I don't know how many countries in the world. I was in Germany and Vietnam. Germany we weren't in a police action with. Vietnam we were. We've got head army in England, France, Italy. I don't know where all we've got them now. And it seems that this wasn't specific enough in prohibitions. And the apportioning of money seems to have lost its merit, because the budgets not only include, say, a contract to develop a new fighter jet, and that contract might go 10, 15, 20 years in the development. So how can, when they give those contracts, they're actually in violation of this two-year apportionment term? But then that's some of the changes that the founding fathers with a clean sheet of paper did not anticipate the contempt that some would have for the intent of the Constitution.
To provide and maintain a navy.
Absolute necessity back then, because commerce with any other country, except parts of Mexico and Canada, had to go by ship. So the maintenance of a navy to protect American shipping, and let's go back to Tripoli, the Barbary pirates, it was the only way to protect American shipping. And so the navy was considered, did not have the limitations imposed upon it that the army had on it.
To make rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces.
Okay, now the land and naval forces come under the executive branch of government. The apportionment and the rules for the government and regulation of these forces resides with Congress. The power to make rules, and you don't give power to two parties because it would be in conflict. The power to make rules for the government and the regulation of the land and naval forces resides with Congress.
To provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions.
Now this gets kind of interesting with regard to the militia. They provide for the calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union. In the early years, they called the state militias to do it. It wasn't until the early part of the 20th century, the early 1900s, where Article 10 U.S. Code 32 was enacted, creating a United States militia, which is in conflict with the Constitution because the calling forth here is of state militias. They're called by the federal government because the army can't be used here, but there is supposed to be no standing army, so the militia would be called when they were necessary to suppress insurrection and to repel invasion until the army could step in for invasion, but not for insurrection. But they made, like I say, in the early 1900s, the U.S. militia was created contrary to the Constitution.
To provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress.
Okay, now just before that, we said Congress shall make rules for government and regulation of land and naval forces. So here's the obligation put on them to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the state militias, and for the governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States. That's where they're calling forth in the previous clause. Reserving to the states respectively. So here we've got the distinction. The appointment of officers and the authority of training the militia according to the states, train the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. Now, Congress hasn't prescribed that discipline, so they've failed in that power. But very clearly in this clause, we see the distinction that the militia do come from the states, the appointment of officers, and the training of the militia is left to the state, but the training according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. So there's no doubt that there's no federal militia, U.S. militia, authorized by the Constitution at this point.
To exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district not exceeding 10 miles square as may, by cession of particular states and the acceptance of Congress, become the seat of the government of the United States, and to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same shall be, for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings.
Now this is kind of interesting because there are two things that are ceded. In 1828, the Act of 1828, for example, gave Congress, the federal government, the authority to punish damage of government property if that government property was on land ceded by the state and jurisdiction ceded. So the cession is two elements, both the land and the jurisdiction. In many cases, the jurisdiction remains with the state government. If somebody's murdered there, it's a state crime, not a federal crime, unless that jurisdiction is ceded to the federal government. There was an interesting case in, I think it was Wisconsin, called, actually it never went to trial. This guy Brown, five or six people were arrested for demonstrating in front of an abortion clinic. And five of them had attorneys and were duly convicted and went to prison. The sixth, Brown, kept challenging jurisdiction. When did show me when the United States had the daycare center location or the abortion center location ceded to them and where jurisdiction was ceded. And he went on for months like this, and finally they dropped the charges and let him out. And I think they reconsidered the other five people and let them out too, because he had challenged the jurisdiction under the authority here. Exclusive legislative jurisdiction in all cases whatsoever over such district, 10 miles square, that's Washington, D.C., as may by session of particular states in the acceptance of Congress become the seat of government of the United States. That's it, that's D.C. And to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same shall be for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. Now, if abortion clinics were needful buildings, they would have to get it from the state and get the jurisdictional authority as well. But they never did that. Okay.
And to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof.
Now this one, the enabling clause, this one, Congress, the federal government has usurped authority where it has none. Let's look at it closely. To make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers. Oh, now, and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States and any department or officer thereof. Now, the Constitution vested powers to government, so that second phrase, all other powers vested by the Constitution in the government of the United States. As long as those powers are vested, they have to be given somewhere, whether it's judicial, executive, or legislative branch, they have to be given, or in any department or officer thereof. Now, that would give it to the executive branch where the departments and the officers exist, but it has to be vested by the Constitution. The problem is they have stretched that to the point of absurdity. And I wrote an article, Liberty or Laws is Felon Possession of a Firearm. Felony possession of a firearm is not legal or lawful, which addresses this very issue. They gave the control over Congress, but they've extended that beyond Congress and into the everyday lives of people because something went through Congress. But the idea of Congress is to keep the states from competing, and the... what was that Lewis decision, Lopez decision in Texas on gun-free school zones proved that. The court ruled that Congress power did not give them the right to control a firearm in a school zone. The federal government, that had to be that was state jurisdiction. So this enabling clause has been abused by the government. This is the primary source of the usurpation of authority by the federal government to the loss of the rights of the states, and not just from the Civil War, but since the Civil War, the encroachment on the rights of the states have been overwhelmingly suppressed. Okay.
Section 9. The migration or importation of any such persons as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit, shall not be prohibited by the Congress prior to the year 1808, but a tax or duty may be imposed on such importation, not exceeding $10 for each person.
So even though there was pretty much a suspension of slavery importation, this allowed slavery importation to go to 1808. But the government could tax those people. They call it migration or importation. Primarily, it was importation.
The privilege
that,
of the writ...
That, by the way, is now obviously non-existent. Section 9, Article 1, no longer has any bearing at all or standing.
The privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion the public safety may require it.
Now, this gets rather interesting. This is one of the few rights embodied in the body of the Constitution. It's not in the Bill of Rights. It wasn't a, in hindsight, we want to protect additional rights. The writ of habeas corpus, what was commonly referred to as the sacred writ, shall not be suspended except by Congress and only when rebellion or invasion, the public safety may require it. However, I submitted a habeas corpus on behalf of Larry Michael Myers to the district court. It's a federal case, district court in Florida. Twice they ignored it. The appellate court, they violated their own rules and sent it back to me rather than do what their rules said and send it to the district court. And I went to the United States Supreme Court with it and finally got it docketed there, even though it was supposed to and was directed towards Justice Scalia, who was in the district where Larry Michael Myers was then detained, and the court chose not to hear it. So, in essence, the judicial branch of government, in violation of the Constitution, has suspended habeas corpus, because if it cannot be heard, it is, in essence, suspended. There's a usurpation by the judicial branch of government that is denying a fundamental right that has this historical background through English heritage going back for many centuries.
No bill of attainder or ex post facto law shall be passed.
Bill of attainder is carries broader than the person charged for immediately for a crime. An ex post facto law is one that would be, say, passed today and apply to something that happened before today. And it makes sense that if it's not criminal when I do it, that I can't be punished for it. However, the government seemed fit to retroactively impose taxes, though I don't know that they've done it to any criminal laws.
No capitation or other direct tax shall be laid, unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken.
Capitation is like a head tax, and the direct tax, which is like the income tax, unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken. Now, this gets kind of confusing with regard to the 16th Amendment. Did it override this, or is the direct tax, the income tax, not a direct tax? My feeling is it's, and I think the courts have ruled on occasion that it is an excise tax, but the question arises then, can they put an excise tax on your ability to make a living to sustain your life? This one is, as far as I'm concerned, this is ignored completely, because it would have to be based on enumeration, not equal throughout as the others, excise, impost, and duties, but based on the enumeration. So if a state had 10 representatives and another one had 20, the amount of direct taxes would have to be proportioned to the twice as much in the state that had 20 representatives. Not the amount of tax, but the total tax collected.
No tax or duty shall be laid on articles exported from any state.
Makes sense, because it would be punitive to allow a state not to export.
No preference shall be given by any regulation of commerce or revenue to the ports of one state over those of another, nor shall vessels be bound to or from one state be obliged to enter, clear, or pay duties in another.
Now, this was free commerce within the states. Now, if it left a state and went to a foreign country, the federal government could do taxes on it. If it came from a foreign country to a state, the government could tax that, but they had to be uniform as per the Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1. And this one had been tested from time to time, and it always came out to the same thing. They cannot tax interstate commerce.
No money shall be drawn from the treasury, but in consequence of appropriations made by law, and a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time.
Oh, boy, this one's been torn all to hell. No money shall be drawn from the treasury but in consequence of appropriations made by law and a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. There are two funds that I'm aware of that have been heavily borrowed from, and there's no public accounting. It's difficult to get the accounting. The people that have done the research have dug deeply. Those two accounts are, one is the Social Security Trust Fund, where the money has gone since 1933 into this fund. And if you look at what is supposed to be in that fund, the idea was it would sit in that fund and would draw interest. Well, the government borrows it. They don't even pay it back, let alone the interest. And so their Social Security is actually paid out with the revenues collected this year to pay out this year. The Federal Highway Transportation Trust Fund. The roads are the federal roads, a lot of them are in a shambles. There's been a transfer of a lot of the federal roads to counties and states, the old state highway system. But the Federal Highway Transportation Trust Fund has received gas tax, excise taxes on batteries and on tires for over a century now. And that fund is enormous, but the government takes money out of that. I guess they appropriated out of it to loan to another branch of government. So we're talking about, according to at least two articles I've read, we're approaching over $100 trillion of debt. But the government doesn't have to count what's owed to the government because it's just going from one pocket to another. So now we've only got $16 trillion worth of debt. But to restore those two funds would take many tens of trillions of dollars to get back in Social Security what it, on paper should be in that account, and to get back into the Federal Highway Transportation Fund what should be in that account, should be in that account according to the contributions to it. So this thing has been bastardized to a point of beyond recognition, and as a consequence, they keep threatening that the entitlement of Social Security, which was paid, bought, and paid for, and our highways, we need to raise taxes. Congress right now, because of the low gas prices, is looking at putting another, I think, 10 cents, like California did, on the gasoline tax. And, you know, we're talking about billions of dollars, many billions of dollars a year, or perhaps trillions, I don't know how many gallons, at 10 cents a gallon, that would be. The price goes down, and they want to slap some more on there so they can borrow it for other purposes and still leave that enormous obligation back to the Federal Highway Transportation Trust Fund, and we'll probably still have nasty roads. So you're beginning to get a picture, perhaps, that the government is not going along with the intent of the Constitution. What they're doing is looking at any way they can to circumvent the intent of the Constitution. And this goes back, in some respects, to early in the 19th century, in the early, the late, or towards the, just prior to the Civil War. Okay?
No title of nobility shall be granted by the...
One. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. No, I missed one. No title of nobility. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No title of nobility shall be granted by the United States, and no person holding any office of profit or trust under them shall, without the consent of the Congress, accept of any present, emolument, office, or title of any kind whatever from any king, prince, or foreign state.
Now, they blanketly allow dual citizenship, which they didn't used to allow in this country, which is interesting. Where is your allegiance if you have dual citizenship? And there are a number of countries that we allow dual citizenship with. But more interesting is, no title of nobility shall be granted by the United States. Now, title of nobility, people think that that oh prince or something like that, some special title. How about your honor in court? What title? The only case that has, we've found that begins to describe title of nobility was a case called Horse v. Moses in Alabama, by heard by the Alabama Supreme Court. And in that case, title of nobility is a grant of title of nobility is to give somebody an authority or a group of people an authority that is not exercised by the rest of the people. Let's get back to liberty and the equality that we look at in this country. Bankers, lawyers, policemen, just to name three, are given a title of nobility because they have extraordinary privileges that you and I don't have. Long story short, they have ignored this completely by convincing us that title of nobility, well, we can't call him prince, but we do have to call him your honor or the honorable, but that's not what it meant.
Section 10. No state shall enter into any treaty, alliance, or confederation, grant letters of marque and reprisal, coin money, emit bills of credit, make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts, pass any bill of attainder, ex post facto law, or law impairing the obligation of contracts, or grant any title of nobility.
Well, we got the title of nobility again. Let me clarify something. Article 1, Section 9 is limitations on the government. We had powers in 8, limitations in 9. And now in Section 10, we're talking about states. This is what had to be done to create an equitable balance between the distribution of authority between the federal and state governments. So a state can't enter a treaty alliance or a confederation. Wait a minute. They have confederations. They have reciprocity agreements between other states. Didn't used to be, Smoking the Bandit, I think was the movie, it used to be that jurisdictional lines were pretty rigid, but now a cop in hot pursuit can chase somebody into another state if it's agreeing a state, and the federal government has actually helped create these confederations or these agreements between the states to allow them to basically destroy any concept of jurisdictional lines that used to exist. They can't grant letters of marque or reprisal. That's reserved to the Congress. They cannot coin money or emit bills of credit. That was reserved to the federal government, and it was also allowed by banks because the bank had its note or its name on the coins or monies that they did. Only the state could be prohibited, but now the banks are controlled to a greater degree than they were a century ago. A bank, if it had gold on deposit, could issue gold certificates, and they did. Or they could coin, they weren't counterfeiting if it met the requirements of the federal government to actually create coins. Make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. Now, that's kind of interesting. A friend of mine in Florida got a traffic ticket down in West Palm. He lived up in the Orlando area. He fought it and lost, and so they imposed a penalty on him in court, and he said, is this a debt? And the judge said, yes, it is. And I haven't talked to him in quite some time, but I know that 8 years later, last time I saw him, this is almost 20 years ago, every once in a while, West Palm County sends him a notice that he owes this money, and he writes back to them and says, I still cannot find a bank that will give me gold and silver to pay the debt that I owe you. And it's been going. Now, in Florida, if you don't pay a fine, they suspend your license, but they've chosen not to suspend his license. So it gets rather interesting when you point out that the state cannot make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. If they acknowledge that it's a debt, they've just said it can't be paid. Nor can they pass any bill of attainder or ex post facto law, same as the federal government, or law impairing the obligation of contracts or grant any title of nobility. Now, this last one, title of nobility, is identical to the prohibition against the federal government passing title of nobility. Now, the interesting one is no state shall pass any law impairing the obligation of contracts. Now, I would assume that the federal government could not pass any law impairing the obligation of contracts either, even though it's not specified. And this came to mind back in 1993 when I was in Waco, Texas. And though the power bill and the phone bill had been paid by the Branch Davidians, the federal government told the power company and the phone company to cut off service to Mount Carmel Center. The federal government impaired the obligation of contracts. The Branch Davidians had been obedient to the contract, and so the power company and the phone company should have been obedient to the contract. But the federal government, for some reason, was able to say, no, you cut the electricity off. By what authority does the federal government get that power to tell the electric company, you've got to cut off his power even though he's current in his bill, his contract? So Congress uses their extraordinary powers, usurp powers, to do what they want, to impose hardship on people whenever they want. Okay.
No state shall, without the consent of the Congress, lay any imposts or duties on imports or exports, except what may be absolutely necessary for executing its inspection laws. And the net produce of all duties and imposts laid by any state on imports or exports shall be for the use of the Treasury of the United States. And all such laws shall be subject to the revision and control of the Congress.
Okay, now this gave the state, the states the authority to, say, dredge rivers or dredge harbors so they could take deeper draft ships, to set up the means of inspection of goods coming in and things like that. And they could tax the importer or the exporter for that, but only to the point that it was necessary to sustain the operation or the maintenance or things like that, and any surplus of that had to be turned over to the federal government. Otherwise, the state would be able to profit, so they'd raise the rates and stick it in their pockets, and that would go be in violation of some of the other restrictions that were imposed by the Constitution.
No state shall, without the consent of Congress, lay any duty of tonnage, keep troops or ships in time of peace, enter into any agreement or compact with another state or with a foreign power, or engage in war unless actually invaded, or in such imminent danger as will not admit of delay.
Okay, no state shall, without the consent of Congress, lay any duty, tonnage, troops, keep troops or ships in war in time of peace. Kind of makes sense because there would be active army troops or ships of war. Lay duty on tonnage, again, that would be giving them a power that would have the ability to affect commerce. Enter into any agreement or compact with another state. Now, these compacts are what I referred to earlier, where the jurisdictions are lost, the lines of jurisdiction are lost, and they can be transcended, and there's common elements. In fact, the fusion centers have become a blatant violation of this compact with another state. Now, the United States, in a sense, is another state to the state government. But the fusion centers, if they're near the border, will bring in people from both states and the federal government. And if the federal government is in another state, then, well, maybe it is a foreign power. or engage in war unless actually invaded or in such imminent danger as will not admit delay. Now, engage in war unless actually invaded. Now, this gets interesting because our California, Arizona, and Texas, and maybe a little bit of New Mexico, being invaded right now. But the federal government denies them the ability to protect themselves from that invasion. And each state has expressed a desire, at least California has been rather quiet on the matter. Arizona and Texas have both objected to the federal government not allowing those two states to repel the invasion that is coming across their southern border. In fact, people that have attempted to curb that invasion have been picked out for punishment. And I guess the most well-known one would be Casey Massey, who was charged with felony in possession of a firearm in violation of federal prohibitions of their authority on commerce, or exceeding their authority on commerce, because he was actively and fairly effectively discouraging invasion at least through a 3 or 4 mile stretch of the Texas border. And the people in Arizona that are down on the border are trying to work with BPS as best they can, but they're also in fear that they're going to be subjected to persecution by the federal government, as Massey was, because of their efforts to curb the invasion coming across their border.
Article 2, Section 1. The executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States of America. He shall hold his office during the term of 4 years, and, together with the vice president, chosen for the same term, be elected as follows. Each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct a number of electors equal to the whole number of senators and representatives to which the state may be entitled in the Congress. But no senator or representative or person holding an office of trust or profit under the United States shall be appointed an elector.
Well, this sets out the authority, the executive power. The executive power is the power to enforce the laws enacted by Congress, and we'll see that there's other aspects to this later, but as the executive power, he administers the enforcement of the laws of the United States, and he set the term for 4 years, and for him and the vice president, and they also leave to the states the method of selecting the electors, and we're going to talk more about electors later when we get to some of the amendments because they've had substantial effects on it. But that's the basic premise, and that still holds true. Okay?
The electors shall meet in their respective states and vote by ballot for two persons, of whom one at least shall not be an inhabitant of the same state with themselves. And they shall make a list for all of all the persons voted for, and of the number of votes for each, which list they shall sign and certify, and transmit seal to the seat of the government of the United States, directed to the President of the Senate. The President of the Senate shall, in the presence of the Senate and House of Representatives, open all the certificates, and the votes shall then be counted. The person having the greatest number of votes shall be the president, if such number be a majority of the whole number of electors appointed. And if there be more than one who have such majority and have an equal number of votes, then the House of Representatives shall immediately choose by ballot one of them for president. And if no person have a majority, then from the five highest on the list the said House shall in like manner choose the president. But in choosing the president, the vote shall be taken by states, the representation from each state having one vote. A quorum for this purpose shall consist of a member or members from two-thirds of the states, and a majority of all the states shall be necessary to a choice. In every case, after the choice of the president, the person having the greatest number of votes of the electors shall be the vice president. But if there should remain two or more who have equal votes, the Senate shall choose from them by ballot the vice president.
Now, there are a couple, for the most part, this has all been superseded, but there's a couple of things in here that give us an idea of the intent of the founders. One at least shall not be an inhabitant of the same state with themselves, and that would be the electors of a state. So what does that mean? Well, that means that we're not looking at a list of two people for one party and two people for the other. Quite often there were five or six delegates or people running for president and vice president at the same time. And as the party system settled out, we began getting changes in this process. The other one, the number of votes of the electors, most votes, if it's a majority, is the president. If it's not, it goes to the House of Representatives, which has happened a couple times in our history. But then the number of votes of the elect, having the greatest number of votes under that, under the majority, would be the vice president. So the vice president could be from a different party or a different political affiliation. So when they looked at this, they didn't conceive of the factional politics, the two-party system. In fact, a number of people, including Washington, were very much against party politics. But what they conceived of party politics back then doesn't even begin to approach what we have now. But we can see by this, though, that they were looking for larger numbers of people to be part of that choice that we get to take. But then they left all the decisions at this point to the state to decide how they're going to elect their electors. And so it kind of lost the flavor that it should have, probably poorly written, to say the least. Okay.
The Congress may determine the time of choosing the electors and the day on which they shall give their votes, which day shall be the same throughout the United States.
Now, that's remained consistent in theory, but when was the last time you know who the elector for your district or your states were? And so it's kind of secretive.
No person except a natural-born citizen or a citizen of the United States at the time of the adoption of this Constitution shall be eligible to the office of president. Neither shall any person be eligible to that office who shall not have attained to the age of 35 years and been 14 years a resident within the United States.
Now, this is the one that there's been controversy before through our history, and with a single exception, anybody who was challenged as to being a natural-born citizen was removed from the ticket. There was no question. If there was any doubt, that person was removed. Now, obviously, I need not explain to anybody that did not apply this time, because that question arose even before the elections. But they've raised the standard to, 35 years, same as a senator, but 14 years a resident within the United States. So they're looking at an allegiance and a large percentage of the lifetime, at least, being a part of the United States. Where there was no question of allegiance.
In case of the removal of the president from office, or of his death, resignation, or inability to discharge the powers and duties of said office, the same shall devolve on the vice president, and the Congress may, by law, provide for the case of removal, death, resignation, or inability, both of the president and vice president, declaring what officer shall then act as president, and such officer shall act accordingly, until the disability be removed or a president shall be elected.
Now, this the Congress will set up who will be after the vice president, and this is kind of interesting because that's changed over time. In my youth, it was fixed. There was a list that we had to learn in 8th grade, I think, of who follows who all the way down the line. The president pro tem of the Senate, the Speaker of the House, and it just went down to it covered about 5 or 6 different levels in case there were disabilities or any removals. But we saw that change when Gerald Ford was elected. He was not the president pro tem of the Senate, and I don't know what it is right now. It's very difficult to find out what Congress has decided, but I'm sure it's far more political than looking at degree of responsibility and working down that ladder.
The president shall, at stated times, receive for his services a compensation, which shall neither be increased nor diminished during the period for which he shall have been elected. And he shall not receive within that period any other emolument from the United States or any of them.
Now, we go back to people like John Adams when he moved into the White House, first president of the White House. Abigail was concerned on how the $18,000 that he got as president a year could afford to pay for the dinners that they felt of necessity they had to have. There was no expense account, and it says for his services a compensation. So here's your services, here's a compensation, which shall be neither increased or diminished during the period which he shall be elected, and he shall not receive within that period any other emolument from the United States. Now, I think that these vacations they take are absurd. Now, perhaps the use of Air Force One for the security of the president, if and his family, if the president attends them, makes sense. But motel rooms in Hawaii or in Africa and things like this, they go overboard. They have become kings. Royalty, and they get all this stuff thrown at them, and they can spend many millions of dollars a year in extravagant expenses. And that is not the intent of this paragraph. It said that, like the House and the Senate, shall receive a compensation for his services. It can't be increased or diminished, and he shall not, within that period, receive any other emolument from the United States. So, well, that one's gone.
Before he enter on the execution of his office, he shall take the following oath or affirmation. Quote, I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
That's the oath that is supposed to be taken, and I think that we saw it get blown this what, 6 years ago. But best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Now, it's just to the best of my ability, and when we think of what Bill Clinton said about the word "if" and the way attorneys twist language. I think they could probably legally claim nowadays diminished ability when they took the oath. But that's what we're stuck with.
Section 2. The President shall be Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and of the Militia of the several states. When called into the actual service of the United States, he may require the opinion, in writing, of the principal officer in each of the executive departments upon any subject relating to the duties of their respective offices. And he shall have power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment.
So that gives his additional duties. The president shall be commander-in-chief of the Army and the Navy of the United States. Now, the question, it used to be during time of war, but now it's become other than that. because we're not at war and he's commander in chief, and of the militia of the several states when called into actual service. He can ask for an opinion in writing from the principal officer in each of the executive departments. The final decision is his, but there have been contests on occasion over his arbitrary authority in some circumstances, minor really, but it would be the administration of their respective offices. And he can grant reprieves and pardons, but wait, amnesty's missing here. Pardon is exempting them from the punishment of a crime after the crime is committed. Now, we had that problem with Gerald Ford. He pardoned Richard Nixon, but Richard Nixon wasn't convicted of anything, and reprieved the same thing. They can suspend the sentence without wiping it off the record, where the pardon would wipe it off the record, but it's become a tool, and it becomes obvious quite often that by some of the characters they've let out of prison who were just thugs, but apparently had enough money behind them where substantial contributions probably resulted in pardons being granted, and usually they're done on the way out of office so that there can be no question of the of what they're doing. You know, it's too late. Once you grant the pardon, it's good. Now, let's go back to the Civil War when Lincoln pardoned all those who fought against the United States, and Congress subsequently, under Thaddeus Stevens, revoked the pardons granted by the president, and Andrew Johnson vetoed that, and the Senate overrode that, so they took a specific authority granted to the president, and after Lincoln died, Lincoln was very strong, Andrew Jackson wasn't. So they undid the deed that Lincoln did right after the war was over. So as far as the government abiding by the Constitution, I think we're beginning to see now that things aren't the way they were intended. These are pretty clear words. The words have meaning, reprieves, pardons, emoluments. All these things have meanings, and these meanings have been long established, but basically, through a process of verbicide, we see things changed by legislative action that are not by amendment to the Constitution. Okay?
He shall have power by and with the advice and consent of the Senate to make treaties, provided two-thirds of the senators present concur, and he shall nominate, and by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, shall appoint ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, judges of the Supreme Court, and all other officers of the United States, whose appointments are not herein otherwise provided for, and which shall be established by law. But the Congress may, by law, vest the appointment of such inferior officers as they think proper in the President alone, in the courts of law, or in the heads of departments.
So they're giving him here, they're giving him the authority to pick the principal actors in the executive branch of government. And it makes sense, but it requires two-thirds concurrence by the Senate. Now, the interesting thing is, if we look back in history, treaties did not protect endangered birds, but now they protect endangered birds. Is that really a treaty? To treat is to come to terms with another country, not come up with a compact, and those treaties now are used to create unconstitutional laws regarding, say, hunting in certain areas where a bird that flies from Mexico to here, that treaty with Mexico protecting certain birds, makes it a federal crime to shoot certain birds. They've also by treaty, the endangered species. Where'd they get the authority to tell the state, a hunter in a state, what he can or can't shoot? Perhaps it's right in some cases, but the treaties have been used now to, we have treaties with other countries regarding marijuana, and that's how the federal government was able to pass anti-marijuana laws when they took a constitutional amendment to pass anti-alcohol laws. It's done by treaty. Now, it's getting a rather interesting states' right test in both Washington and Colorado, where they have basically nearly decriminalized marijuana, and to some degree in the medical marijuana states where the government's the federal law is in direct opposition to state law, and the federal government has on occasion tried to enforce them, but they tend to be backing away for whatever reason they chose to. Maybe they don't want the appearance of a conflict between state and federal laws to become too apparent to the people, or the people might begin questioning where the federal authority comes from.
The president shall have power to fill up all vacancies that may happen during the recess of the Senate by granting commissions which shall expire at the end of their next session.
And that's, we see that come into play when they want to control something and make an appointment without Congress. They wait until Congress is out and then make the appointments. And then Congress ends up with the uphill battle of saying, you can't do that, or going along with the president for the assignments he made. But, yeah, that's the power. He should have a degree of authority on who he's hiring, but that's patronage, too, by granting commissions like Postal Commission, in the old days, the tax commissions and things like that. And it was a major problem, they found out, in terms of patronage, and created some substantial problems. In fact, Marbury versus Madison has to do with some commissions that were issued and never delivered. And the whole issue was, are they real commissions if they weren't delivered? But they were commissions that were done at the end of a term when Congress was not in session, and they carried on to Madison, the next president. Okay.
Section 3. He shall from time to time give to the Congress information of the State of the Union and recommend to their consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient. He may, on extraordinary occasions, convene both houses or either of them, and in case of disagreement between them, with respect to the time of adjournment, he may adjourn them to such time as he shall think proper. He shall receive ambassadors and other public ministers. He shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed, and shall commission all the officers of the United States.
Okay, now this has a State of the Union, and recommend for their consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient. He can't dictate. He has to request, but then that's where patronage and other things come in, where he can get votes ahead of time. He can reconvene. He shall receive ambassadors and other public ministers. Now, the interesting thing there, that was the only thing that Abigail Adams figured the government had to pay for, was when they received ambassadors and other public ministers, and she was wondering if the government would only provide the food for the ambassadors or public ministers, or would also include it for the Adams family during those occasions. But he shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed, and shall commission all officers of the United States. Faithfully executed. That means if it's law on the books, for example, the immigration laws we have now, his obligation is to faithfully execute those laws. They haven't been changed, and he can't change them. But he's done it with the amnesty. He's done it through the Internal Revenue Service, which is an executive administrative agency, where they're giving amnesty bonuses to people that never paid taxes in this country. So usurpation in the presidential level begins to become very apparent here. Okay?
Section 4. The President, Vice President, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, and other, or other high crimes and misdemeanors.
Okay, now people want him charged with treason, and We'll get into treason a little later, but here again, we've talked about this. The House of Representatives impeaches him, and the Senate then would be necessary two-thirds to convict him. But this includes all officers in government, but again, like we mentioned earlier, it's out of the hands of the people. It's strictly within the Congress, whether somebody gets impeached and whether they get convicted, no matter what their office is. They could be a judge, any of the higher offices of government. It's all in the hands of Congress.
Okay. Article 3, Section 1. The judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court, and in such inferior courts as the Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. The judges, both of the supreme and inferior courts, shall hold their offices during good behavior, and shall, at stated times, receive for their services a compensation, which shall not be diminished during their continuance in office.
Okay, now here they have established a Supreme Court, which I think began with 5 justices, and now we're up to 9. It might have begun with 3, I don't recall. But they were initially circuit riders. They actually went annually to their circuit to hold cases. There weren't that many federal cases. And then Congress was given the authority in Article 3 to create inferior courts, which they have all the way down to the appellate courts for each circuit. And there are 9 judicial circuits, appellate courts in each of those circuits, district courts thicker than flies on manure throughout the country now. And so they've extended their judicial authority well beyond what was ever intended by this. And we'll get into jurisdiction in just a minute. But if we take and look at this and the limitations, we might need other courts if we have so many cases. They weren't looking at the virtually hundreds of different federal courts that exist right now, not counting the administrative ones like the tax court, things like that. Okay.
Section 2. The judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, and treaties made, or which shall be made under their authority, to all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, to all cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction, to controversies to which the United States shall be a party, to controversies between 2 or more states, between a state and citizens of another state, between citizens of different states, between citizens of the same state claiming lands under grants of different states, and between a state or the citizens thereof, and foreign states, citizens, or subjects.
Now, that's a list of jurisdiction, but they'll be amended shortly with the 11th Amendment of the Constitution, because what they found is they had opened their law and equity court up a little too broadly to be dealt with. And it gets back to the concept that if there's a contract, the contract will be adjudicated in the state in which the contract shall be made.
In all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, and those in which a state shall be party, the Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction in all the other cases before mentioned. The Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction, both as to law and fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make.
Again, we're talking about jurisdiction, original jurisdiction, and appellate jurisdiction. Minorly affected by the 10th Amendment or 11th Amendment.
The trial of all crimes, except in cases of impeachment, shall be by jury, and such trial shall be held in the state where the said crime shall have been committed. But when not committed within any state, the trial shall be at such place or places as the Congress may by law have directed.
Pretty interesting that the trial shall be if it's committed within a state, the trial will be held in the state, but the federal government frequently changes venue. Probably the best example was Timothy McVeigh, and I don't know if Stephen Jones concurred or not, but I would think it would take both parties to agree. But it's kind of a classic one back from the 90s, too. Bo Grice was charged with having a counterfeit passport in San Francisco, and it was tried in Nevada, not in California, and they dropped the charges against him. But it's a matter of jurisdiction, and jurisdiction now permeates everything, federal jurisdiction. Okay?
Section 3, treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them, or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. No person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony of two witnesses to the same overt act or on confession in open court.
Now, there have been some interesting treason trials. Aaron Burr, I think, was charged with treason, but they couldn't find two people. He was conspiring to take on the United States government and create a new country. He became a part of government after that. But they could not find two people to the same overt act. Now, the enemy there was they were going to, and this was the foundation, they were going to go to war with the United States. Now, we hear this cry of treason. Treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them, which is what Burr was going to do, or in adhering to their enemies and giving them aid and comfort. Now, in 1942, the press cited this case back a few years ago, but they never read it, I don't think. In 1942, in Ex Parte Curin, that's Q-U-I-R-I-N, it had to do with five Germans who had snuck into this country and been caught. They were German soldiers in civilian clothes, but they weren't under war. They were being tried as enemies. Now, the Supreme Court in that decision did a number of things. They pointed out that the President and Congress had declared war against Germany on December 15th, 1941, so a state of war existed. And then they went on after that and talked about what an enemy was. Absent a declared war, there is no constitutional enemy, so the only thing that would qualify somebody for treason would be if they were Americans and they were levying war against the United States, which is what Aaron Burr was doing. So these people that yell for treason, we want to impeach him for treason, that just doesn't cut it. You can't say treason in terms of the Constitution unless you satisfy the condition, and that condition, as the Supreme Court established in 1942, is when there is an act of war, there is an enemy. Okay.
The Congress shall have power to declare the punishment of treason, but no attainder of treason shall work corruption of blood or forfeiture except during the life of the person attained.
Okay, now this is, Congress can determine the punishment, but interestingly, they had, no attainder of treason shall work corruption of blood. So the family of the person that commits treason, unless they were convicted too, which was the that couple that was convicted and executed during World War II. I can't think of their name right now. But otherwise, it can't affect the family. And any forfeiture only during the life of the person attained it. So it sets a limitation, but the punishment can be, you know, life imprisonment, 60 days in the county jail, or execution, depending on what Congress writes into the law, which is varied from time to time as well.
Article 4, Section 1. Full faith and credit shall be given in each state to the public acts, records, and judicial proceedings of every other state. And the Congress may, by general laws, prescribe the manner in which such acts, records, and proceedings shall be proved, and the effect thereof.
Now, this is kind of confusing. Full faith and credit shall be given in each state to the public acts, records, and judicial proceedings of every other state. This implies, then, that most crimes will, to some degree, murder, kidnapping, things like that, will, to some degree, be adjudicated in every state, and they have to give full faith and credit. Whether that full faith and credit means if somebody flees, that he has to be returned, but that doesn't sound quite right. It's kind of an equalizing thing, and I really don't understand it. And the Congress may, by general laws, prescribe the manner in which such acts, records, and proceedings shall be proved and the effect thereof. Now, Article 4 deals with the states. Now, whether they're saying that the federal laws imposed within a state would be true in every other state, but see, they don't hold to that because each district or circuit now is, or federal district court is saying whether same-sex marriages are illegal or not. So obviously the discretion even at the district court level now is to ignore previous proceedings and do what they want. So we've got judicial activism, and whether it's we're talking about the states or the federal within the states with this Section 1, Clause 1, it's not being applied now. Here's another usurpation. These judges are usurping and ignoring the proceedings in other states. So that's the third branch of government usurping authority. Okay?
Section 2. The citizens of each state shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states.
So this one is rather interesting, again, along the same line, because the citizens of each state is entitled to the privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states. Let's just say somebody is allowed to own a firearm in, oh, let's just say Oklahoma. But say he's a felon, federal felon in possession of a firearm, but Oklahoma law allows him to do it, and he goes to Texas, and Texas law allows him to do it. Now we get a conflict of laws again. Now that's addressed in the Liberty or Law series. Felon in possession is not illegal or unlawful. But again, they've ignored this whole consideration. Now, another one that came up during the Bundy Ranch affair is, what about all these militia people who went to Nevada? Well, in Nevada, you can open carry firearms. So somebody comes from another state with a firearm, they're not transporting it, they're carrying it with them. Transport's a commercial term. So as long as there's not another factor involved, the question was, can they have firearms? Because when the unrustling, after the unrustling, they said they're going to charge all these people. Well, nobody's been charged as a consequence of what happened there yet. But quite simply, the Constitution says if I can legally carry a firearm in Indiana or New York or anywhere else, and I go to Colorado, then I can legally carry it there because I have the rights and immunities. Now, this also applies, I suppose, that if I go to another state and join their militia, because I want to go there, just like the people from Rhode Island and New York and Connecticut and other states went to Boston and encircled Boston. They were in a different state. They were militia from there. So the privileges and immunities of the citizens in the several states obviously carry certain privileges when we cross boundaries that cannot be removed from us. It gets even more interesting, though, that if I am from an open carry state and I go to a state that doesn't have open carry, we've got a serious conflict that seems to conflict with both this and the Section 1, the one that preceded it, if everything's supposed to be balanced. So they're giving discretion to the states to usurp basically the Second Amendment rights. Now, when I say Second Amendment, I should say Second Amendment equivalent, because each state has its own Declaration of Rights, which has provisions that may be restrictive to some degree on firearms, but only to the extent that is well within the authority granted by the state constitution of the state you go into. Okay?
A person charged in any state with treason, felony, or other crime, who shall flee from justice and be found in another state, shall on demand of the executive authority of the state from which he fled, be delivered up, to be removed to the state having jurisdiction of the crime.
Now, this is interesting. People say the Dred Scott decision wasn't fair, but the Constitution provides the return of slaves, and we'll run into that again. If they fled from one state, they had committed a crime within that state, and they had to be extradited back to that state. Extradition, and they say treason, felony, or other crime. I don't know that anybody's ever been sent back for a misdemeanor, so I don't know what they mean by that, but the compacts the states have created, they actually transfer jurisdiction quite often, especially in, say, child support, that if somebody goes to another state, the state that he left, rather than being extradited back there to be charged, they'll actually transfer authority on the judicial system of that state to the other state to collect the child support or take his driver's license away in his way of making means of making a living. So, you know, a lot of this stuff has been convoluted, especially Article 4, which basically was states' rights. Okay?
No person held to service or labor in one state under the laws thereof, escaping into another, shall, in consequence of any law or regulation therein, be discharged from such service or labor, which shall be delivered up on claim of the party to whom such service or labor may be due.
Now, see, this goes a little bit beyond jurisdiction, because if I own the slave, I can put in the claim. I don't need the executive of my state. Now, this has been removed by virtue of the 13th Amendment, but there were people that were indentured servants for a period of time, and if they fled, they had to be returned at the request of the person. There were a lot of Irish that were indentured servants. There were Scottish that were, and a lot of this had to do with what went on in England during various times. There were a lot of indentured servants that were captured by the Scots, the Irish, or the English, taken prisoner, and then shipped over here as indentured servants to cover the cost of their transport. And then once they were done with that period of time, then they were free. But this law was to protect the right of the person that had the obligation owed to them to not be denied that obligation because they fled to another state. But that has been superseded by the 13th Amendment since there's no more involuntary servitude. Okay.
Section 3. New states may be admitted by the Congress into this Union, but no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state, nor any state be formed by the junction of two or more states, or parts of states, without the consent of the legislatures of the states concerned, as well as of the Congress.
Now, this gets kind of interesting. In the Plan for Restoration of Constitutional Government and some other articles that I've written, I point out that the first blatant violation of the Constitution occurred in 1861 when the Virginia legislature did not give the consent for the separation of West Virginia. And it says, nor any state be formed by the junction of two or more states or parts of states without the consent of the legislature of the state concerned as well as the Congress. So parts of states, it was part of Virginia. Virginia had made concessions at the forming of the Constitution as to what their western boundary was, and West Virginia was within that. They never gave their consent. They claimed they had seceded from the Union. Lincoln said, nobody seceded, they're just criminal. They're not acting in accordance with the Constitution. So that means that, you know, the Constitution still applies. So making West Virginia a state was absolutely a violation of the Constitution. They needed a quorum in Congress for certain votes, and so they through force of arms and by other means made a state and argued later the necessity of it afterwards when it was challenged and the courts upheld the decision. One more interesting aspect of this, the Northwest Ordinance was first passed under the Articles of Confederation. It was reaffirmed by the new Congress in 1789, I think it was, and the Northwest Ordinance said that any new state entering the Union does so with equal footing to the other states. Now, the states that were in the Union at the time, if there was any land that was king's land, it reverted back to the United States, who relinquished it to the state. The United States won the war, and the treaty gave it to the United States. They relinquished it back to the state. But then as the Western expansion went, the federal government began holding more and more land and not giving it to the state for them to put out. And Nevada's the best example, where I think 85% of it is still owned by the federal government. In Arizona, it's something like 40%. And Arizona and Nevada could be prosperous states if that land were released, which was the intention of the Northwest Ordinance, but Congress got greedy, and they used that for patronage, because they'll sell it to people at auction in blocks too large for an individual to buy, but a large corporation can afford to buy, say, 5,000 acres and then develop it and make a large fortune in the process of developing and reselling it. So, you know, since 1861, the Section 3, Clause 1, has been thrown out the window completely.
The Congress shall have power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States. And nothing in this Constitution shall be so construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or of any particular state.
Okay, now this gets rather interesting. In the 1850s, there was a rape case in the Oklahoma Territory. Now, in that case, the United States Supreme Court pointed out that there are three different conditions that exist. We have states that have their executive constitution approved, legislative, executive, and judicial branch of government. And as the court said, they make their laws, and they enforce their laws. Then there's territories that have been approved partially, where they've created legislative, executive, and judicial branches, but their constitution hasn't been written and or approved, nor has Congress recognized them as a state. But as he pointed out in that decision, the same applies with them. Once Congress grants them executive, legislative, and judicial authority, that takes it away from Congress. Congress no longer has it. And the third condition is, which the portion of Oklahoma at that time, the Oklahoma Strip, where the crime of rape occurred, that comes under Article 4, Section 3, Clause 2, to make all needful rules and regulations, because no executive, legislative, judicial branches had been set up, so they're still under the executive, legislative, and judicial of the federal government. And so when we look at this one, the power to dispose of the land and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States. But they can't intrude upon the rights of the state in doing that, which is kind of what they do. Shall be so construed, and nothing in this Constitution shall be so construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or of any particular state. Now we get back to, I'm going to use Nevada again for an example. 85% of Nevada is being held by the federal government, and it's a prejudice to the claims of the state. Why should the federal government still be making rules? Nevada was made a state during the Civil War, 1863, 4, somewhere around there. During the Civil War, it was made a state. And they did not get the equal footing that everybody else got, and that land now for over 150 years has been held by the federal government at the prejudice of the claims of the state of Nevada. So the second part of this clause is out the window. Now, the first one, Congress makes rules and regulations in conflict with state law. And let's go back to felony and possession of a firearm. If state has executive, legislative, and judicial, then Congress does not, as per that 1850s decision on rape that I mentioned. Congress does not. They relinquished it. They granted by statehood that authority to the state. Now, Congress does have, under the Constitution, the authority to regulate commerce. And that article I mentioned just a little while ago, liberty or laws, felony in possession of a firearm is not illegal or unlawful, uses an analogy that commerce is, you've seen an overpass, a walkway overpass over a highway. There's a stairway up, there's a walk across the road and a stairway down, and then there's sidewalks at the stairways. Once it enters commerce, somebody ships it, it goes up the stairway. It's transported across the walkway, and it's received down the stairway. But once it leaves that, according to that 1850s law, now it comes under state purview, but the government has extended their reach all the way up and down the sidewalk, at least on the receiving side. They haven't done it on the sending side yet, but they probably will. Now, that was overturned in U.S. v. Lopez, a Texas decision, written almost identical to the felony in possession. It was a gun, firearm, help me, Sleepy, what's the firearms around a school?
Firearm free zones. Gun free zones
around schools. And the court said, hey, you don't have authority there. It's only in commerce. But they still leave that provision stand in felony in possession, and it's in conflict with that 1850s decision because the entire realm, except the commerce granted specifically, regulation of commerce granted specifically by the Constitution of the federal government, they have no jurisdiction. And this applies to the marijuana laws, and the reason they're probably backing out because they don't want the clash of laws to occur in public, so people would say, what the hell are you doing? But people need to know that. Okay.
Section 4. The United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a republican form of government, and shall protect each of them against invasion, and on application of the legislature, or of the executive, when the legislature cannot be convened, against domestic violence.
Okay, now they have on occasion responded to domestic violence. Now this isn't household violence. They use that same phrase, domestic violence, for a man beating his wife or a wife beating her husband. But domestic violence, they have it in Arizona, they have it in Texas, they have some in California, the border states, and even the other states. I guess Tennessee's had some problems with it and everything else. So let's go through this. The United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a republican form of government. Republican form of government, that means our elected officials represent us in the state legislature, the legislative, executive, and judicial branch that we just talked about. But if they pass a law, in the federal, for example, queer marriage laws, does that mean that the federal government can take away a little bit of that republican form of government because this state did not want queer marriages, and the federal government came in and said they you have to give queer marriages. Alabama's going through this right now. And she'll protect each of them against invasion. Well, what is happening on the southern border when you've got thousands of people sometimes a day coming across the border? The fact that they're not coming with artillery and rifles does not mean it's not an invasion, because all they got to do is come across the border and get rifles and start shooting from behind us. And on application of the legislature, of the executive, when the legislature cannot be convened against domestic violence. Arizona and Texas have both applied to the federal government to deal with the violence that's crossing the border. And they're told that they can't do anything, even though the federal government doesn't do anything. So this one is out the window. It's thrown out completely. It's gone. The federal government has usurped the authority, and almost everything in Article 4, which is basically states' rights, has been yanked out of the Constitution, thrown away, and the federal government has assumed the authority of a king who can do no wrong in dealing with all those matters addressed.
Article 5. The Congress, whenever two-thirds of both houses shall deem it necessary, shall propose amendments to this Constitution, or, on the application of the legislatures of two-thirds of the several states, shall call a convention for proposing amendments, which, in either case, shall be valid to all intents and purposes, as part of this Constitution, when ratified by the legislatures of three-fourths of the several states, or by conventions in three-fourths thereof, as the one or the other mode of ratification may be proposed by the Congress, provided that no amendment which may be made prior to the year 1808 shall in any manner affect the first and fourth clauses of the ninth section of the first article, and that no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate.
Okay, now here's the Fifth Amendment article and we'll link an article that I've written on the Fifth Amendment. That provision that says no amendment which may be made prior to the year 1808 shall in any manner affect the first and fourth clauses in the ninth section of the first article has to do with slavery, servitude. But the rest of it is kind of interesting. We've talked in the introduction about the history of ratification and the fact that they had learned from the states that the ratification had to come from the people. In this, though, there's a couple problems. There have been over 100 applications for a convention of states. However, they've been spaced apart. Now, I would think that it would make sense that those calls would have to come within a session of Congress because, the 86th Congress should not have to respond to calls from the 85th Congress, so that two-year window might make sense. And I don't think there's ever been three-quarters within that period because the states just are unable to get coordinated with regard to calling for a convention. So in our entire history, 240 years, we have yet to have the state convention that's called for. So but then the government will interpret that the way they want to, because it says on application of the legislatures to two-thirds of several states, the Congress shall call a convention. So we've never gotten there, and I doubt that we ever will. Then they talk about the mode of ratification, legislatures of three-fourths of the states or by conventions of three-fourths of the states as one or the other mode of ratification may be proposed by the Congress. Now, here the Congress has the discretion of saying state legislatures can ratify or the people can ratify, and it's kind of inconsistent that it isn't left to the people to ratify, because the states could ratify, unless you were watching C-SPAN today or reading the paper meticulously in the past, things would be ratified without you even knowing it until after it was ratified. I don't know if Prohibition would have succeeded had the 18th Amendment, had the it been a convention of states. And I don't know that there's ever been a call for a convention within the states for ratification. They've always left it to the legislature. Um, there's just this process was not well thought out, and it is inconsistent. And by being inconsistent, now we go back to the states realized that the Constitution could be changed by the legislature if the legislature enacted it. And so they opted that the people had to, in convention, ratify the state constitutions prior to 1787. They also, at that time, amendments to their constitutions had to be by the people of the state. Now, a number of states have enacted laws that, and California is one of them, that if there's a referendum on the ballot and that referendum passes, it becomes a part of the Constitution. But most people don't realize that they're amending their Constitution by that enactment. Now, one that was recent in California, and this is back to the Republican form of government that's guaranteed, the people of the state of California, by referendum, enacted a law that only recognized male-female as a marriage, a husband and a wife. So it became a part of the California Constitution. However, the district judge here, or a circuit judge, I think it was a district judge, overruled that and said that's unconstitutional. So if we have a Republican form of government, and that Republican representatives of the people, but the people only can amend the Constitution, and the people amend that Constitution, that's the epitome of a Republican form of government. But the federal government can say, oh, don't, no thanks, we don't like it, you can't do it. So the usurpation by the judicial branch, the third branch of government, is complete in terms of judicial activism. They actually make laws from the bench. Now, I got to go a little further while we're talking about this. The picture I'm beginning to see that organizations like Southern Poverty Law Center that garner millions of dollars from liberal contributors have, and let's throw in Al Sharpton and people like that too. If you have enough money in a lawsuit, you can make it so expensive for the other side. And if they can't muster the cost of fighting, and this is going on in Alabama right now where SPLC is wanting to overturn the state law that says that man and woman is a marriage. If they've got enough money, it's very difficult for that to be challenged, whether there's any legal merit to it or not, just because of the way the courts work. So money and the courts have become the legislators in this country, within the states, and perhaps to some degree within the federal government, because federal statutes point out that administrative agencies will only recognize a marriage between a man and a woman. However, the Internal Revenue Service, which is an administrative agency, has completely ignored that by giving benefits, tax benefits that go to a married couple filing jointly, to queer marriages filing jointly. So there's so many conflicts between the Constitution, the laws, the statutes, the state constitutions, the state statutes, and the federal courts, that basically what we're talking about here has no merit. It's inconsistent in the amendment process, and the amendment process has really come to a point of meaning nothing. And I would wonder what would happen if the sufficient number of states called for a convention to have a constitutional amendment that required recognized only a marriage between a male and a female, if the Congress or some administrative agency might find some way of avoiding calling for the convention that's required should two-thirds of the several states call for it.
Mm.
So Constitution, out the window. Constitution's a damn good document if we abided by it, if the government abided by it. The Constitution created a government. That government's primary purpose was to protect life, liberty, and property. Its secondary purpose was to govern the government. But instead, it can't govern itself because of the conflicts I've talked about between statutes, amendments, and the courts. But it tries to govern the people, and that was never in the Constitution. It was never given the authority to govern the people. And we have become governed by the government that fails to govern itself. So now we'll go to Article 6.
Article 6. All debts contracted and engagements entered into before the adoption of this Constitution shall be as valid against the United States under this Constitution as under the Confederation.
Now, this is something that's similar to what was in the 14th Amendment that people complained about, but you recognize debts. The reputation of the United States was dependent upon repayment of debts to Holland, France, and any others, even to individuals, that many of them gave up their wealth supporting the Revolutionary War. So it's just a recognition, an acknowledgement that they're accepting obligations that were entered into by under the Articles of Confederation, and they're valid now under the Constitution.
This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made, or which shall be made, under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary, notwithstanding.
Now, remember earlier we talked about the laws between states and the recognition of those laws, but now we're seeing that they're saying that if the federal government passes a law under the authority of the Constitution, it would apply to the states. Now, either the other one is worthless completely, or under the authority of the United States is a limitation on the federal government as far as what they can do. So let's look at this closely. This Constitution, yes, that's understood, and the laws of the United States which shall be made in pursuance thereof, that means within the authority, the powers and authorities granted to the federal government, and all treaties made, and now treaties back then were something different than they are now. They've just changed, they've made compacts with other states. They're not real treaties. They're not trade treaties. There's no exchange or anything. Prisoners aren't returned. Land isn't given back or anything. So the general elements of the old treaties have been redefined now, where they have compacts with other states that are a way of getting around that made in pursuance thereof, and which shall be made under the authority of the United States. Well, it's an authority the United States doesn't have as far as the treaties. Shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby, anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. So by the expansion or usurpation of authority by the federal government, anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. That's where we've come full circle, and the states, for all intents and purposes, right now, are simply a method of indexing maps for Rand McNally when they make their map books.
The senators and representatives before mentioned, and the members of the several state legislatures, and all executive and judicial officers, both of the United States and of the several states, shall be bound by oath or affirmation to support this Constitution. But no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States.
Well, this is a requirement that we saw in Article 2, where the specific wording of the oath was provided for the president, that they will take an oath to the United States Constitution and to the state constitutions when they're within a state.
Article 7. The ratification of the conventions of nine states shall be sufficient for the establishment of this Constitution between the states so ratifying the same.
Now, this is the count, and we talked about this in Philadelphia Conspiracy, but people felt that when it came out of Philadelphia in 1787 that they had taken away all these rights, but it was sent to the Congress under the Articles of Confederation, who decided to forward it to the states without comment. So in a sense, the Articles of Confederation blessed the ability, based on the Declaration of Independence, the right, the duty to change it, passed it to the states, but the condition was that nine states had to approve this, now ratify it. Now, those that ratified it at that point, once the ninth state ratified and the United States under the Constitution came into existence, it left the remaining four states in a rather interesting area. They were still members of the Articles of Confederation. There was nothing that would force them into the Constitution except their own ratification of it. Rhode Island, I think, was the one that held out until the Bill of Rights had been submitted to the states for ratification. But there could have been two countries if the other four states had not ratified. And people don't think about that. It was a voluntary action, and each of the states that ratified, it was done by convention by the delegates that came from the people themselves. But that was the kickoff point when the United States government came into existence, and we gave the date on that in the first part of the series.
Done in convention by the unanimous consent of the states present the 17th day of September in the year of our Lord 1787 and of the independence of the United States of America, the 12th.
Now, independence of the United States of America, the 12th, that was that's where they began counting, beginning July 4th, 1776. This is the 12th year because it's not January 1st, it's July 5th that begins a new year. But done in convention by unanimous consent of the states present the 7th day of September. Now, people say, well, there's people that walked out of the convention. Yes, some of them walked out specifically so that this unanimity clause could be put in there. Nobody remained on the 17th day of September in 1787 because they didn't want to impede this. They might have felt that they were going against the instructions they had from their state, but they did not stay in the convention to make it other than unanimous. So even those that left and didn't like the Constitution, in a sense, concurred or went along with the consensus and allowed the unanimous vote to be demonstrated by leaving the convention center. And after that, follow the names of the people that signed. And that then led to the creation of the United States government under and by the Constitution.